From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Penny Nelson. The Final Days in Vietnam is the title of a new movie by award-winning filmmaker Rory Kennedy. And those final days, with North Vietnamese forces marching on Saigon, were steeped in enough chaos, confusion, and desperation to merit a film such as this. Many people are familiar with the photo of people frantically trying to get aboard a helicopter on a Saigon rooftop, but less familiar is the story leading up to that moment, and the story of so many remarkable servicemen and women who followed their convictions and broke with Army protocol to get South Vietnamese who were at risk out of the country. Ahead on Forum, we talk with Rory Kennedy about the film and the stories she heard. That's coming up on Forum next. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. Good morning. I'm Penny Nelson. And this is Richard Nixon in 1973 announcing the end of the war in Vietnam.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam.
We have adopted a plan for the complete withdrawal of all U.S. combat ground forces. We are finally bringing American men home.
But as seems to so often happen in complicated war zones, unknowable factors end up driving events in directions few might expect. When Richard Nixon resigned due to the Watergate scandal, the North Vietnamese were emboldened, and despite the Paris Peace Accords, they started a southward march with plans to take cities all along the way to Saigon. The American ambassador was reluctant to recognize the threat and would not accept any talk of evacuation. He felt deep to his core that there was no imminent danger to the Americans or the hundreds of thousands of South Vietnamese who'd fought in the war or worked for or alongside the Americans. Stubborn, proud, determined, optimistic, call the ambassador what you will, the North Vietnamese drew closer and U.S. military's men and women started taking matters into their own hands.
People like myself and others took the bull by the horns and organized an evacuation. In my case, that meant friends of mine who were senior officers in the South Vietnamese military. As the North Vietnamese came closer and closer to Saigon, these people were dead men walking.
Award-winning filmmaker Rory Kennedy's new film documents this fascinating period of time in her new movie, Last Days in Vietnam. It was a frantic, chaotic, desperate, and frustrating time for so many, and ended up being an evacuation debacle that in some ways mirrored the whole Vietnam War. Rory Kennedy is the co-founder and president of Moxie Firecracker Films and has directed and produced over 30 movies, including Ghosts of Abu Ghraib and Ethel, which is a movie about her mother. And this movie that we're speaking about today, Last Days in Vietnam, is going to be showing now around the Bay Area. Let me throw out some times here. It's going to be showing at the Opera Plaza Cinemas in San Francisco, but those shows are sold out. So you head on up to Shattuck Cinemas in Berkeley on Saturday, September 27th, and there will be a Q&A after a noon show. Also, if you're interested, you can look through the Landmark Theaters Bay Area directory and see what the times are, or go to lastdaysinvietnam.com. And I will repeat that a little later in the show for those who want to make sure they get a chance to see the movie. Well, Rory Kennedy, first, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And let's start with the second piece of sound that we heard in the introduction. That was Army Captain Stuart Harrington and talking about taking the bull by the horns. And I'd like you just to explain for us what leads up to a point where an Army captain is saying, we just decided to take the bull by the horns and act outside of Army protocol.
Well, it's an amazing moment, and there were many of them just like it that are documented in the film, where both Americans and South Vietnamese went against what was then U.S. policy to just get the Americans out of the country. At that point, as you said in the beginning of the program, the Paris Peace Accord had been signed 2 years earlier, so there was no military presence, American military military presence in the country. There were about 6,000, 7,000 U.S. personnel, people who were protecting the embassy, Marines, other types of folks there, but there was no military personnel. And what happened was there was the peace accord. The North then broke the peace accord, came into the South. They thought it would take 2 years to get into Saigon. But because there was, in part, no military presence from the U.S., the country fell like a house of cards. And so instead of taking 2 years to get to Saigon, it took 4 months. And this took the Americans off guard. They weren't prepared. They didn't have a proper evacuation plan really in place. The ambassador was very resistant to acknowledging that the country was falling and refused to put an evacuation procedure in place and green light that, in part because he was so attached to the idea of South Vietnam as it was, and he had lost his son, many personal reasons. But in any case, a lot of people on the ground saw what was happening, and they did what they could to save the South Vietnamese. They worked with the South Vietnamese. Many of them were friends and family with the South Vietnamese, and they knew they were vulnerable.
Let's back up a little bit and talk about unintended consequences, because certainly so much of what is in this film was new information for me. The whole storyline was, other than that one or two iconic pictures that we've seen over the years of people filing up some steps to get on a helicopter on a Saigon roof, really the depth of this story is unfamiliar to me or any of the people I was talking to. And it sounds like from what you've said, so many people don't know about it.
Well, you are not alone, Penny. That's what I have to say to you, which is amazing. And I throw myself in there as well. I thought I knew so much more. And I actually, when I decided to do this film, I was kind of resistant because I thought, well, everybody knows this story and what can I bring new to the equation? And then in doing screenings with politicians, with historians, with people even who have studied Vietnam, they don't know this history. People who were there don't even know what happened because there was such confusion. And it's an extraordinarily dramatic story. It's a hugely important moment in our nation's history. What the Vietnamese went through to get out of the country and get to our country during that time. And then, of course, the many stories of the Vietnamese who were left behind and what happened to them. It's such an important story. And I think also, you know, in the context of what we're working through right now as a nation and getting out of Afghanistan and Iraq and what the implications are, I think there's a lot of insights that we can learn from what happened in Vietnam. And honestly, as we engage in new wars and involvements, I think there's also insights about what happens at the end of the war that can help us when we get and start the process of getting into a war.
Well, back to this unintended consequences concept. When the idea that Richard Nixon stepping away from the presidency emboldened the North Vietnamese, that they thought, according to the film, they thought he was something of a mad dog, you know, that he was erratic, or there was something about him that they definitely were not sure of. But once he left, and the kind of the crazy factor had gone out of the American foreign policy strategy, they thought, bring it on.
I know.
And they start marching.
It's an amazing story. And I didn't realize that. And, you know, I'm a Democrat, and you know, never thought I would make a film that suggests that Nixon should have stayed in office for any reason.
Was there any press following this series of events, sort of the domino of that was connecting the two back then?
There was awareness back then, but I don't think there was a huge amount of awareness. But there's definitely a sense now looking back. Listen, I think that the North was going to come in to the South no matter what, and that was their intention. That was their plan. My understanding is their intention was to do it later, not at that point, but they saw a vulnerability when Nixon resigned and Ford was put into place. And then, you know, they recognized that we had elected a Congress that was an anti-war Congress, that you know, our country was really done with Vietnam.
War fatigue.
So they had, you know, they had confidence that they could go in, and they went in. They started coming in from the north to the highlands and kind of waited to see what America's response was to that. It toppled very quickly and we didn't come back. What few people know, both at the time and even looking back, is that Nixon had signed a letter to the president in South Vietnam at the time, President Tu, saying that we will come back with full military force if the North comes in. Of course, this was a secret letter. It wasn't authorized by Congress, so it was completely illegal. You know, our Constitution says that Congress has to approve any war that we go into. So he didn't really pay much attention to that. And, you know, he put forth this agreement and promise, which of course we didn't stand by,
which gave them a false confidence. They, the South Vietnamese, a false confidence.
Yes, and ultimately, I think that was the only reason that they would agree to the peace accord as it was signed, because I think they saw that, you know, that it was transparent and that it was really a document that probably was going to be hard to sustain.
Now, hindsight, of course, is 20/20, and especially when you're watching a documentary. That gives you the visual maps and everything. But let's talk a little bit about the ambassador, Graham Martin. You know, he in various turns in the film, he comes off as frustratingly stubborn and unwilling to consider the ramifications of his optimism, I guess. He would not consider an evacuation. And my understanding is that there were four evacuation protocols that were at the ready, and had they used the first three, they stood a chance of doing a really efficient and effective evacuation of both the Americans and a substantial number of South Vietnamese. But they ended up, of course, using their least favored, least effective plan.
Yes.
So talk about the ambassador and just his complicated story.
Yeah, so there were four plans that involved getting out on cargo airplane and fixed-wing aircraft and ships, you know, which are far more efficient than what the fourth option was, which is helicopter airlift, because they're just ultimately, even in the biggest helicopters, you might be able to fit 40 people, maybe 50. But, you know, on an aircraft or a ship, you can fit hundreds of people. So this was really an option that they weren't excited about, but ended up having to do because the North bombed the airport. So there was no way to get out of the airport. And the ships had gotten overcrowded, so they couldn't use the ships. So they had to resort to this fourth option, and then they only really had 24 hours to pull it off. So it was kind of a desperate situation, and leading up to that point, the ambassador was very resistant to the idea of greenlighting an evacuation. Part of the reason, I think, is justified, and the film opens with a scene in Da Nang where the North had come in and taken over Da Nang, which is a small city a larger city, actually, north of Saigon, and there was full-on panic there, and that's where you see that scene with the aircraft where people are chasing the airplane down the runway, grabbing on to the open aircraft and hanging on to the stairs. I mean, it's such a moment of total desperation and the horror of that. And you know, the ambassador was aware of that and didn't want that level of panic to happen in Saigon, which I think was understandable and justified. And once you say we're starting to evacuate people, then everybody's going to want to get out of the city. And so that was part of his justification. I think he also really believed to the bitter end that they could negotiate some peace accord offerings that would still allow for some semblance of a South Vietnam to exist. And he was getting information that legitimized that. And I think he was, you know, like our leaders can do, they get attached to a particular narrative and they surround themselves with people who legitimize that. And I think he did that. And so he was very resistant. And, you know, there was a group of people who just saw it as clear as day that the country was going to fall. And they knew that their South Vietnamese counterparts, friends, family were going to be particularly vulnerable because of their association with America and because of their involvement in the fight against the North, and that they were going to be potentially killed, tortured, or thrown in what many of them were into these quote-unquote re-education camps, which was basically hard labor. For many years, one person who's a character in the film, Dam Pham, was in one of those places for 13 years. You know, so there was real consequence, and these guys understood that and appreciated that, and so they did, you know, they went against policy and they did what they could to get the Vietnamese out of the country.
And we'll play a clip now. This is from the movie Last Days in Vietnam, and this is a situation that Rory Kennedy was just referring to, where officers lower down were aware of what was going on and how the trajectory was not going in their favor. And this particular one, I think this is Stuart Harrington too, is telling – oh, it isn't that gentleman. But he's telling a South Vietnamese officer that he's going to get him out. But, of course, this is still on the down low. Nobody knows it's really happening, and everybody's having to decide really quickly what they're going to do. And, again, going against orders from above. So very brave for those servicemen and women who were choosing to do this. So this is a clip from the film Last Days in Vietnam.
One Vietnamese colonel who was putting his family on the plane, he had wanted to stay in Vietnam to defend the country. And this full colonel had like 8 kids and a wife. And he was in tears, the family. The family were in tears. And I said to him, get on the plane. Just go. Go. It was a terrible, terrible, terrible moral dilemma for everybody.
And Rory Kennedy, you say that is of a captain, Army Captain Stuart Harrington.
Yes, that was Stuart Harrington, and he's such an extraordinary man, and really plays a significant role in the film because he was really on the ground during these events, and he helped initiate the Black Ops. And that clip that you just heard was during that period in early April. The country really fell on April 29th, but in earlier in the month, he initiated this process where he'd put people in vans, take them to the airport, and sneak them in the back of cargo aircraft, get them out of the country. And there had been another guy who had done something similar, and the ambassador had found out about him and fired him and sent him home and made a big stink about it. So, you know, people really recognized that their jobs at the very least were in jeopardy. And during that final 24 hours, and most of our film, you know, it's a little bit more than an hour and a half, but probably the last hour takes place in those last 24 hours, right? And so during that time, you know, people really put their lives at stake in order to get people out. And we talked about the ambassador. And he turns out to be a complicated character because, you know, he was so resistant, and he's sort of, you know, people think of him as the evil villain of the film in the beginning, but then he makes his turn. And once the evacuation plan, you know, was greenlit, when they clearly had no other choice after the airport had been bombed and they had no other way out of the country and they were told they had to get out within 24 hours, they sent a helicopter from the fleet, which was out in the South China Sea, to the embassy, which was told to get him out first, and he refused to get on that helicopter. And he then spent the rest of that day, I think the first helicopters came around 2 in the afternoon, he spent the rest of that day filling the helicopters with as many South Vietnamese as possible, knowing that once they filled them with all the Americans and the Americans were gone, they wouldn't send any more helicopters. And he didn't leave until 3:45 in the morning when he got a presidential order telling him he had to leave, when really you have no choice when the president tells you to do something. So, you know, he kind of is quite heroic during those final hours and really did what he could. You know, one might argue it was too little too late, but you know, I do credit him for the courage he took during those final minutes.
Well, and that's the complicated, that's again this complicated context of war, because watching of the film, I was very angry with him, his hubris and arrogance, but if he had just, you know, acknowledged earlier on so many more people, the 425 South Vietnamese left on that roof thinking that more copters were coming when they weren't, they might have been out. So it's complicated, and yet you can't second guess what was going through somebody's mind.
Well, you refer to, I think, one of the really amazing moments of the film also with Stuart Harrington, where he's in the embassy And, you know, they're in the embassy complex. There were somewhere in the 2,000, 2,500 people range of people in the embassy, mostly South Vietnamese who were trying to get out. And, you know, people were climbing over the doors and trying to get in and whatnot. So that was sort of the final number. And so they were getting the helicopters and filling them. And Stuart Harrington, who spoke Vietnamese, was then at 3:45 in the morning after the ambassador left, was told that there was only going to be one more helicopter and that he had to be on it and all the Americans had to be on it. And there was just a handful of Americans left at that point. And so he was told that he had to go tell the 422 people, because there were still 422 Vietnamese in the embassy who had been told all along that they would get out. They were now on American soil. He had to go tell them that they were going to get out. And he promised them that he would get them out and that he would be the last one to leave. And he made that promise to them in Vietnamese. And then he snuck out to the back of the embassy and went up the back stairs and got on the last helicopter, or one of the last helicopters, out, because of course there were the Marines there who were left behind who were forgotten about, but that's another story. But anyway, so he, and the door was open in the helicopter and the light was just coming up, and he saw these 422 people that he had left behind, and he told he would get them out. And he thought, you know, how wrong this was and how it was the Vietnam War in a microcosm of promises made and promises broken.
But not for not trying. I mean, that's the thing that's so remarkable.
Yes.
Is that it's a disaster. It's a debacle. It's a disaster. It's an embarrassment. But when you drill down and see these individual stories and the Herculean efforts that they were making to just save one more person, to catch that one baby in their arm that's being thrown from a helicopter, it's not like they weren't trying.
No, it's a beautiful thing. But, you know, you talk to Stu and he really, you know, he's a guy who I think really suffers from stress and post-traumatic stress because of these moments, because it's on, you know, they're on the front lines of this and it's on their shoulders, and these huge decisions that are, you know, have the potential of life and death for people they're making on the ground. They're making, you know, based on their own sense of what's right and what's wrong.
Well, we're talking this hour with Rory Kennedy, and she's a filmmaker and has just produced a beautiful film called Last Days in Vietnam that's now available in the Bay Area. And to find out where it might be playing in the times, you can check out Landmark Theaters Bay Area and see where it's playing. You can also go to lastdaysinvietnam.com. I know it's playing in Opera Plaza Cinemas in San Francisco, but I think those shows are sold out, and it will also be shown. Those shows are sold out for tonight, so just keep on top of that. And you can also find it at Shattuck Cinemas in Berkeley this coming weekend. Also, just as I say, check out Landmark Theaters Bay Area for the specifics. And I want to get to some calls. I'll put out the number, 866-733-6786. If you'd like to join in the conversation, that's 866-733-6786. Or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. And in the second half of the show, we'll talk a bit about the making of it and her experiences with the soldiers and all. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson, and we're talking this hour with Rory Kennedy. She's an award-winning filmmaker whose new movie is called Last Days in Vietnam. You may recognize her work and her name from other films such as Ghosts of Abu Ghraib and Ethel, which is a movie that is about her mom. But this one, Last Days in Vietnam, covers the extraction, basically, of Americans and as many South Vietnamese as were possible in that last 24 hours out of Saigon at the end of the Vietnam War. And it's got compelling footage and interviews and tells a story that remarkably very few people know in its entirety. So it's a new piece of material for lots of folks, whether you think you know a lot about the Vietnam War or not. Let's go to a clip and then talk a little bit with Rory about her filmmaking process. And this clip is to set it up. Why don't you set it up? It's the one with the helicopter over the boat.
This is an amazing story and moment in the film. So basically what was happening is there was the fleet that was out in the South China Sea, and helicopters were going from the fleet to the embassy, picking up people from the embassy and going back to the fleet. And what happened was is the South Vietnamese Air Force had basically crumbled, as had the entire military. But there were still pilots, and they still had their smaller Huey helicopters at their disposal. And so many of these helicopter pilots, South Vietnamese helicopter pilots, got into their helicopters and filled them with their families and friends and started chasing the Americans out to sea, not knowing where they were going, not knowing if there was a place to land, which is such a remarkable thing in and of itself and speaks so much to the desperation of that moment. I mean, can you imagine getting in a helicopter with your kids and not knowing if you were going to be able to land somewhere, and if you can't, that
and
you would perish?
Flying out over the ocean, right?
Yeah, because you only have so much gas. So it's an amazing thing. And so there was this ship called the USS Kirk, which was protecting the fleet. And it was the first ship that you would come to if you were going from land out to the fleet. And so our film then switches to the Kirk's perspective, and they look on their radar, and there are all these helicopters coming out towards them, and they have no idea if they're enemy, who they are. But they stop and they start hovering over the USS Kirk. And so they don't know who they are, but the captain makes the executive decision, again, not getting approval from Washington, to bring the first helicopter down. First helicopter comes down. It's a helicopter made for four people. 13 Vietnamese get out of the helicopter, South Vietnamese. We are so grateful to be there, and they've been, you know, ostensibly saved by this crew. But this ship isn't made for landing helicopters, and they only have one small helicopter pad. And so the 13 people get off, but there are 5, 6, 7 other helicopters hovering overhead. They say to the captain, what should we do? And the captain says, throw that helicopter overboard. Let's make room for the next one. So some people might be familiar with the images of the helicopters being thrown off of the backs of these ships. And that's the backstory, you know, which is an incredible story, which many of us don't know. And so they throw the helicopters off and make room for the next one and the next one and the next one. So on this particular ship, that was happening. But then a ginormous Chinook helicopter came with the two propellers. And on the USS Kirk, there's a pole that's in the center of the ship that shoots up. And so there's no way a helicopter that large could land without jeopardizing the ship or the helicopter. I mean, everybody would be destroyed. So they wave the guy away. But the helicopter pilot, as it turns out, had his 5 children and his wife on board and was running out of gas and couldn't make it out to the fleet or any other place. So he then makes the decision to hover over the USS Kirk. And you have to keep in mind that the USS Kirk is moving through the water at maybe 7 knots. He hovers. They open the door of the helicopter, and he proceeds to throw his children probably 18 feet from the helicopter to the ship's deck. And he throws his children, including his 8-month-old baby, his 2-year-old, 5-year-old, 8-year-old, 10-year-old, overboard, his wife, and then a handful of other people who were on the helicopter, overboard, onto the ship. And the crew, not really knowing what's going on, is standing there. They see this thing flying through the sky, and they catch it. It's a baby. It's a child. They catch each and every one. It's an amazing moment. But then, of course, the helicopter pilot is still in the helicopter and can't land and has no options. And so he takes the helicopter to the starboard side of the ship, about 50 yards out. He leans the helicopter over to the right, and he jumps out the left door. The helicopter goes down, explodes. He goes down, disappears. There's dead silence. And then 30 seconds later, the pilot pops up. And it's this incredible moment, and everybody's cheering on the ship. And, you know, they go and pick him up on a little rubber raft and bring him, and it reunites with his family. It's such an amazing, extraordinary moment. And, you know, one of the great things about that story for us is that a lot of it is covered with video and photographs. So we have this extraordinary video that's never been seen before of that moment, as well as a whole range of other extraordinary moments that happened on the USS Kirk, because we ended up if you don't mind me telling you, because it's a great story. We ended up, there was a guy who I know who worked with the U.S. Navy, and he had helped uncover the story of the USS Kirk. And so I was talking to him and saying I wanted to profile the Kirk in my film. And he said, you know, I was talking to a sailor from that ship a few months ago, and he told me that he was up in his attic and came across a box of Super 8 footage from the Kirk in 1975. Would you have any interest in that? Of course, I said, yes, I'd have a lot of interest in it. And so I called him at 9 o'clock the next morning, literally, and ended up flying him out to California because he was very protective of it. And we developed it out there, and it was a treasure trove. So that story is in there. So many other amazing moments in the film. We used, I think, 12 minutes of his film of footage, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a huge amount.
If you had seen that bear, you would have thought that's something to build an entire movie around. Like, exactly. What is the story there?
Yeah.
So, okay, let's hear some of that. This is a clip from that moment.
This big Chinook showed up. There's no way he can land on Kirk without impacting the ship. He would have killed everybody on the helicopter plus my crew.
It was way too big to land. We thought that the helicopter would just fly away. But as the ship was moving forward, probably 4, 5, 6 knots, something like that, the pilot communicated that he was running low on fuel.
He opened up the port side of the helicopter and he hovered across the stern, the Kirk. Then all of a sudden, here comes a human.
One by one, we jump out. I jumped out, my brother jumped out. My mom was holding my sister, obviously very scared. And she just, you know, just trustingly, just with one hand, with her right hand, holding on with her left to brace herself, you know, just dropped my baby sister.
One fellow standing there, and he said he looked up and he saw this big bundle of stuff come flying out, and it was a baby. It was the one-year-old baby.
And that's from the film Last Days in Vietnam. And Rory Kennedy, who made that movie, is with us this hour in the studio. We'll talk a bit about making that movie. But first, let's go to some of the calls that have been patiently waiting. We've got Lee calling us from San Francisco. Good morning, Lee.
Hi, good morning. I look forward to seeing this film, but I have to say it brings up a lot of conflicting feelings. I was evacuated in 1968 during the Tet Offensive. And that was one of the first major evacuations. And what I find so remarkable is there's a lot of oohing and aahing about these moments. And I realize you're out on a roadshow selling the film, and that's all very well and good. I think people need to see it. But it seems very naive to me. you know, war is very chaotic and very contradictory and extremely hypocritical. And these extremes all come together in moments of distress. And they're very explosive and unfortunate, but, you know, to go sort of like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening, bespeaks of a privileged vantage point that most of the people who experienced the war did not enjoy.
All right. Well, let's hear Rory respond to that. Thanks for the call.
Well, thank you, Lee. And I so appreciate what you're saying. And you know, as I'm talking about it, I'm kind of highlighting in the direction the interview is going, these moments of heroism, both from the South Vietnamese and the Americans. But the context that we tell this story in is very much the context of the Americans leaving the Vietnamese behind. And, you know, that act of, and you know, the story that I talked about of Stuart Harrington leaving the 420 people behind at the embassy is very consistent with the tone of the film, which is, you know, this, and we highlight stories of people, Vietnamese, who were left, because that is the dominant story and that is what happened to most people. And we really don't shy away from that in the context of the film. I've been lucky enough to show this film throughout the country in New York and Washington and many communities. And I'm very proud of the Vietnamese response to the film has been overwhelmingly positive. And I think, you know, there's a sense that the film has a very sensitive portrait and considerate portrait of the South Vietnamese perspective. The film is Last Days in Vietnam. So overall, the film is from the American perspective. But it I think, really tries to recognize that, you know, these events are all within a larger context of abandonment. And I don't shy away from that in the context of the film at all. But I appreciate your perspective and where you're coming from. And I do hope that you'll see the film, and I hope that you'll agree that we're sensitive to that perspective.
Well, and I would weigh in saying that my remarking about all the heroism, what is so clear in the film is the chaos and the one hand not necessarily ever knowing what the other hand's doing, which is what you hear is a real reality in war, and the frustration on the part of the very people that end up being so heroic. But it's not like this was not a walk in the park for anybody. People, it looked like people were terrified, they were frustrated, they were angry, and it was all chaos, which is why it ended up being the circumstance it was. So,
and I would say that the film also distinguishes, which I think is important in war, between the policies that were being initiated in Washington, which, you know, we interviewed Kissinger and other people who were putting those policies in place, and then the people on the ground and what they were doing. And those two things are very different. And I think that, you know, largely the South Vietnamese have been, you know, very warm and welcoming generally. You know, when you talk to Americans who've gone to Vietnam, they speak always of how receptive and warm the Vietnamese people are to Americans. And I think that that's in part because the Vietnamese also recognize that there's a difference between the policies that are put in place by Washington and these wars and the people who may operate on a different set of assumptions. And I think you see that in the film where they're being told to do one thing by the higher ups and they choose to do the right thing on the ground. And I would add that many of our heroes in this film are South Vietnamese who are doing extraordinarily courageous things, not unlike the helicopter pilot, but also we have a story in there, Kim Do, who along with Richard Armitage saved 30,000 Vietnamese. I mean, really, Kim Do is the hero of that story, and that was really important to me to recognize the heroes on both sides of this.
All right, let's hear from Hugh calling from Walnut Creek. Good morning, Hugh.
Good morning. Rory, this is Hugh Vasquez, a friend of Arne Kagi's. We've been kind of communicating since you did The Fence, and I first want to say terrific work. Appreciate what you have contributed to the world in your various films, and I'm really looking forward to seeing this one. I'll see it tonight in Berkeley, but I did want to ask you about your deepest motivation for doing this film. We could have left all stories of Vietnam behind by now, but you brought this out, and I'm wondering what was really stirred in you to bring this film to life?
Well, thank you, Hugh. It's nice to hear from you. I think that for me, Vietnam is a seminal moment in our nation's history, and I've always been fascinated by Vietnam. My father was Robert Kennedy, and in 1968, he really ran that campaign because he wanted to get out of Vietnam, and that's why he ran in that election. So I think it was always part of my childhood, kind of the ether. I also felt, now that we're nearing the 40th anniversary this April, that it was a good time to look back, where maybe people could have less raw response to the events and be able to have a little bit more perspective on what happened. But most of the people are still alive, frankly, and can talk to us. The film only we only interview people who were on the ground in Saigon at the time or in Washington helping to make the policies. So there are no historians who are looking back. There's no narrator telling you what to think. It's really a firsthand account of what happened. And that was really important to me because I didn't want politics involved in this. I wanted it to really document these events so that we understood what happened. And then, you know, people can look at them and make sense of them and bring to them what they want. But I wanted it to be as neutral as I possibly could.
I'm sorry.
Just add that because we're, you know, getting out, and at that time when I was developing it, on the brink of getting out of Iraq and Afghanistan, I did think that there were potential lessons from what happened in Saigon 40 years ago to the events that are taking place now in our country. And indeed, I think that's the case.
And that's what I was just going to ask you about, the context of when you started making it, where we were in that process. And now that as we look like we might be diving into more terrain, more war terrain, you know, the importance of a strong and clear exit strategy can't be overstated.
Yes. And I think that's one of the lessons I learned in making this film, which is that by April of 1975, it seems to me that there were very few good options available. And even, you know, there was debate as to Congress passing an aid package of $720 million, which I think would have helped and made a difference in people's lives. But I don't think it would have changed the course of events in a significant way. And so I think that it's really important to understand what the exit strategy is and what the end goals are as, you know, when we start these engagements, because that's when you have most control. Once you start a war, you know, you can lose and things can get out of your control and lots of things happen that you don't anticipate. I think it's also a reminder, the human cost of war, and a reminder about our responsibilities to the people on the ground, because these are people who might be our translators, might be the drivers, might, you know, be agents, might be working in the field, whatever they are. But when we leave, they're more vulnerable because of their association with America.
How common is it, was it, for a single person? I mean, for like the ambassador, the American ambassador, Graham Martin, he really held the power in his palm of whether or not there was going to be a better evacuation option or not. And is that usually the case? Is that the case now? How does it work?
Really are the representatives that control those countries and decisions made in those countries to a large degree. I think that we now have better communication just because we have better communication ability than we did then.
Were you surprised that a single person could hold that
surprised.
Much sway?
I was surprised, but I've then, you know, subsequently researched it, and indeed that's the case. You know, those people are really representing our country and are able to make decisions within that context.
Now, how'd you find some of these people, especially the South Vietnamese folks?
Well, we found them mostly through you know, there were a number of people who wrote books about these final events and what happened. And so we read those books and reached out to a number of those people. And, you know, like most things, when you start researching it, that seems very broad and difficult to kind of contain, but then you kind of find everybody starts referring to the same people.
And I imagine that would have led to like six different storylines, but you did. It was a matter of finding the intersection.
Yeah, so then you have to contain it really more than it was a challenge to reach out to people and find them. It was a question of sort of deciding who should represent a storyline and who was in the best position to do that.
And then all that videotape. So we got a bunch of it from that attic. But were
Dan
you,
Lucero,
did
a
you who
shout
did
out
you
to
have
him.
To work through to get access to all this stuff? And you interviewed Henry Kissinger, some of which ended up on the cutting room floor, it looks like. But is that right or not? No?
Yes, okay. For sure.
But your efforts at getting film, was this a long term labor
of
love?
It was a a priority to me to really try to have a visual style with this film that was based on not doing reenactments and not doing kind of too many graphics, but really trying to ground the stories and what we were showing with the footage to support it. And so that was a big priority. So we went, you know, I had a team of people that I hired who do this for a living and are very good at it, and, you know, who went to the archive houses. And so instead of just getting clips by making a call and saying, tell me what you have on Vietnam, or the last days, they would go into those houses and actually look through the material and try to get, you know, to the source material and not just to what had already been highlighted on the nightly news or in other documentaries. And so we went very deep. And so I think, you know, for anybody who watches this film, they're certainly going to see an abundance of material that they've never seen before.
How did this get covered at the time? So when this was going on, it's, as you say, we've all seen a few images repeatedly over and over. But at the time when this was taking place, I know it was a big embarrassment, and so probably there was as much of it swept under the rug as possible. But the investigative reporters of the day, how did it get covered?
Well, you know, I think that it's a good question because that's part of, you know, like you were saying in the beginning of the interview, you think that you know this story, right? And I think particularly people who are maybe older than you and I, who might have lived through it and watched it on the nightly news, feel like they knew it. But the nightly news at the time was showing such chaotic images that it was hard to make sense of it. And then once they were done with those images, I think everybody in this country wanted to move on, and they didn't want to revisit Vietnam. And maybe they visited in a cultural sense, but not in, you know, with stone documentaries or films, you know, dramatic films or other representations, but not kind of the real life documentary approach. And so I think that part of it is the ability to look back on those events and create a narrative that helps make sense both from the perspective of what was happening on the ground at the time and through the nightly news, because that's part of the source material that we use, but then also in Washington, what decisions were being made in Washington, how that was being communicated on the ground. You know, I mean, I did the interview with Kissinger, and I have to say that he was remarkable in his ability to recall the events down to the minute. And he would talk about how, you know, he was told they needed the helicopters because the airport had been bombed. They were supposed to be there at whatever, 11 in the morning. He was operating on Greenwich Mean Time. They were operating on Vietnam time. And so the helicopters came 3 hours late, you know, that they had stopped the airlift at 7 in the morning or 6:30 in the morning. They thought they had gotten all the Americans out. Then they found out that there were still 11 Marines who were left on the rooftop, because, again, of a miscommunication. So the level, you know, we take our communication for granted now, and the ability to, you know, pick something up and get a text from somebody, you know, 3,000 miles away or 7,000 miles away on a text within seconds. But back then it was hard to make calls and it was hard to reach people, and they were operating on limited amounts of information and making decisions based on that. And, you know, so as you say, you can now look back and have some clarity, but at the time, and we try to represent that in the film, the level of chaos and confusion.
And very likely so many of these people who were doing dramatic things on boats and in helicopters, they were not likely ready to come right back and start touting their stories. I mean, it would have
been
the time
of processing.
That's
right. And, you know, and in talking to people, for example, on the USS Kirk, they'll say, you know, we never thought of ourselves as heroes. You know, we just were doing what we needed to do.
All right, let's go back to the calls. We have Carolyn calling from Burlingame. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to touch on a point that refers to abandonment and embarrassment, which you've talked about. And I think although your film focuses on Vietnamese people, I think there's a group that's really been abandoned by the U.S. government, and those are the former pilots and employees of Air America, which was a wholly owned U.S. government
CIA corporation from 1950 to 1976. In your iconic photo, the man helping the people up onto the rooftop is a CIA employee with full federal benefits. Of course, he's passed away since. The pilot of that plane is Bob Caron of Air America, and he does not and has never had federal employee benefits. And that is because in 1975, 1976, the CIA wanted to move away from having had a proprietary like Air America and built the Air America complex. And so the Office of Personnel Management would never acknowledge that these people had worked for the government. They were not contractors either. They could not save for their retirement.
And Carolyn, I have to stop you there just because we're running out of time, and I want to give Rory a chance to make a comment on that if she'd like to. But thank you for your point, and we're just running out of time. Rory?
You are absolutely correct. That was an Air America pilot. I agree with you. They should absolutely get benefits. So I think that's a good cause and a good area of focus.
All right. Well, and thanks, Carolyn. Sorry to cut you off there, but we are out of time, and that is it for this hour of Forum. And thanks so much, Rory Kennedy, for coming in. I know you've got a cold and you're fighting bravely through it. So thanks so much for being with
Thank
us.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you.
Once again, Rory Kennedy's newest film is called Last Days in Vietnam, and we're going to point you to lastdaysinvietnam.com to find where you can see it most readily. It's sold out a couple places, but that's just for tonight. So poke around and you can find it somewhere in the Bay Area, if not at several places. So take a good look. Well, Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer this hour is Howard Gelman, and Amanda Stupai is our engagement producer. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you have a great weekend. I'm Penny Nelson, and you're listening to KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.